This is a CBC podcast.
Blog trouble in Big China. The infamous Australian porn cracker. And Mr. Rogers goes to Washington. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. There are 66 bloggers in the world today who are in prison for things they said on the internet, and 51 of them are jailed in China. The Chinese government's suppression of free speech is by now old news. You've probably heard about how Google buckled to the ruling Communist Party's pressure and censored mentions of democracy and other sensitive words from their Chinese search results. You may have read more recently about how the executives at Yahoo compromised themselves even further, handing over information to the Chinese government that identified dissident web users, who were then thrown in jail. Just last week, you may have read about Jingjing and Chacha, the adorable little cartoon police who pop up on Chinese web pages every 30 minutes to remind internet users that they're being watched. The fact that China is a dangerous place to start a blog is, as I said, no big secret. But here's something you may not know. Over 30 million people in China do it anyways. That's 30 million people reporting on what they see around them every day, in a place where what happens every day can be pretty shocking. For instance, there was a blog story earlier this year about these two teenage boys who went missing until their parents pleaded with the public through the internet for information. Pretty soon, someone posted photos of the boys, badly beaten and working as forced laborers in brick kilns and mines. It turned out that they had been kidnapped by a slave ring that was paying kickbacks to local cops and officials. The whole thing blew up into a national scandal that no one would have known about before the internet. Then there was this blog post protesting a massive petrochemical plant that was set to be built in the tropical city Xiamen. The story got zipped around the country through cell phone messages. Soon it sparked a huge national protest. The propaganda department ordered a media blackout, but it didn't really matter what the state press said. Thousands of Chinese were already blogging about it. There are tons and tons of stories like this. And bit by bit, they tell a bigger story. The instant history of China itself. And the most interesting part is, all of the blogging is itself becoming part of China's history. Maybe a big part. A couple of years back, the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote that by giving the Chinese people broadband internet, the Communist Party was digging its own grave. Reading what's happened online since, how the mere act of talking about what's happening has changed what's happening, you get the feeling Kristof was right. And yet some Chinese bloggers wonder if their words aren't falling on deaf ears. The novelist and blogger Yang Hengjun recently asked his readers, "The Chinese people are talking, but is the world listening?" Well, welcome to Search Engine, a show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture and everything else. In the weeks to come, this show will listen closely to bloggers and podcasters in China, and in Canada and parts in between. We'll scour the internet for compelling and curious stories you may not find anywhere else, and we'll bring you the voices of people who have chosen to take note of what they see going on around them. We'll also scrutinize what we find online and do our best to make sense of our increasingly spastic culture. We hope you'll listen. And we hope that some of you will even help. This show is going to be a testing ground for new kinds of collaborative journalism. More on that later. For now, our first broadcast continues with more on China, by way of North Carolina. Stay with us. There's a blogger in China named He Weifua, who has written hundreds of articles investigating and criticizing the ruling Communist Party. In China, that can be very dangerous, and reports emerged last week that Weifua has been forcibly confined to a mental institution. But while Weifua may be locked in a Hunan asylum, his words are safely out of the reach of the Chinese government. They're in North Carolina, on internet servers operated by Boshun.com. A news website that delivers the writing of hundreds of Chinese bloggers back to China and all around the world. Boshun's founder and editor is Watson Meng, and he joins me now from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Watson.
Hi, Jesse.
Watson, what can you tell me about He Weifua? Is he all right?
He just was forced to be hospitalized in a mental hospital in China. He is a very normal, logical person. That's my opinion on him. Yeah.
So you're saying that you don't believe that he belongs in a mental institution?
No.
Is there any chance of getting him out?
Yeah, now, the media start to pay attention to this case. And it's really up to the authority, local authority, what decision they will make.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases like some people kept in the hospital for years.
Do you know anything about the conditions in the mental hospital?
No, for those information we don't have. Even his family does not want to talk too much. But his mom did say because his articles often make some people not happy. So that's the reason why he is hospitalized.
Well, let me ask you about that, Watson. What exactly did he write about on his blog that got everyone so upset?
I would say very good writing. Mm-hmm. Very, very good thought.
But very politically pointed, very, would you call him a dissident?
Yeah, based on what he wrote, yes, he should be a dissident, political dissident, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that that the news is paying attention to it and that might help get him out sooner rather than later. And I was wondering, I know that the mainstream media in China is state-controlled, so why is the story getting the attention that it is?
This type of story will not be published in China, in the media. Even up to now, no media say anything about his incidents. Yes, pressure should come from the international media.
And as I understand it, the way that this story got to the international media was through your website, through Boshun.
Yeah, we did release the news very quickly, and then, like Reporters Without Borders, they pick up the case and they made a news release.
I'd like to know more about your website, about Boshun.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Boshun was founded in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it started as a model like a citizen journalist.
So you were doing a citizen journalism website in the year 2000?
Yeah. But at that time, I did not know the word citizen journalism.
Uh-huh.
Only in the last few years, I saw the word, I checked the definition, so we are in that category.
How many people blog on Baoshun.com? How many writers do you have?
Now we have registered about 1,700.
1,700 not, writers?
Yeah, but not all of them active.
Uh-huh.
I think active ones should be around 1,000.
Watson, let me ask you this. Is this the first time that one of your bloggers has run into trouble with the Chinese authorities?
No. In 2004, we have one blogger. He also was a reporter to us.
Mm-hmm.
And he was arrested in 2003. And he got a 12-year sentence in 2004.
What was he writing about?
As a news and some personal stories. And some political contents. So he started to organize a party on the internet, the first one, I believe, in Chinese community.
He tried to start a political party?
Yeah.
When one of your bloggers is arrested, what recourse do you have? Are you able to help them?
Depends on, what case. But like the first person arrested, we launched one petition on internet so people can sign up to support him, And also we open donation to these type of people.
And I suppose you can do what you can to publicize his story.
Yeah, if we think publicize will not hurt their family, we will do that.
Mm-hmm. How many people read Boshun?
It's a monthly unique IPs is about around 1 million. So currently, Boshun almost breaks news every day. So you ask, Jesse, how many readers we have. We don't have that much many readers, I will say, But whatever we break the news, it's picked up by other media too.
You only have a million readers yourself, but when the stories get picked up, that number grows.
Yeah.
I suppose in China with 1.3 billion people, a million doesn't seem like much. In Canada, that's a pretty good number.
Yeah, no.
Well, let me ask you this, because I read this on Boshun that last week Microsoft and Yahoo, their China divisions, signed a pledge that the government asked them to sign that requires all bloggers to register their real names.
Yeah, the new requirements to blogging in China, that's a very bad thing in China. You know, the reason why the government require bloggers to use their real name is because really each blogger is becoming a broadcasting station.
Mm-hmm.
The government basically is losing control day by day now. Because a regime, one fact is very important to regime is the media, the information. The regime will change either willingly or forced to change.
And this is forcing them to change.
Yeah.
Watson Meng, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jesse. Nice to talk to you.
Watson Meng is the founder and editor of Boshun.com. Their new English language service is online at boshun.us. That's boxun.us. There's no hotter issue online than digital rights, and no bigger voice on that issue than Cory Doctorow. He is an author and an activist whose thoughts about privacy and free expression are read by over 2 million people through his group blog Boing Boing. From time to time, Cory Doctorow will come on to Search Engine to share these thoughts with you in a feature we call Copy Fight.
Under Stalin, Soviet science was driven by a madman named Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko rejected the idea that genetic traits are just passed on by parents' genes, and instead believed that you could change an animal's offspring by changing the animal itself. If you cut one leg off a mouse and bred it, the little mice would have one leg smaller than the rest. Do it for enough generations, and you get three-legged mice. Well, it's garbage, of course, but it was comforting garbage. Lysenko's spiritual descendants are the pitchmen for Digital Rights Management, or DRM, the magic technology that's supposed to stop copying from happening with computers. You know what, though? No digital rights management technology has ever stopped the widespread, unauthorized, out-of-control copying of media, and no technology will. Computers are machines for copying data. A good computer is one that copies well, quickly, and cheaply. The internet is a machine for moving copies of data around. When the internet works well, it copies data quickly and cheaply. But DRM is designed to stop copying. It doesn't work. DRMs are designed by ambitious, well-funded consortia with top-notch engineers from every corner of the industry. They spend millions, they take years, and they are defeated in days for pennies by hobbyists. When DRM rubs us the wrong way, we have an easy alternative. You see, unfortunately for the media companies, we inhabit the networked world, where every customer is only seconds away from a computer, a browser, and a search engine. You don't have to be a genius hacker to get a copy of Ratatouille. You just need to plug Download Ratatouille into Google and get that copy that some more skilled person has thoughtfully made available for you. Ideologically, this may be difficult for some people to accept. If your fortune was made by stopping people from copying information, this is an inconvenient truth. If you earn your living by preventing copying, your only options are to change how you do business or deny all of it. Lysenko thought that he could change the laws of nature, but his theory wasn't just harmless junk, it was a fatal lie. When the state applied Lysenkoism to the business of planting wheat, famine followed, millions starved, the Soviet Union fell into a long, grinding, corrupt decline. DRM is just Lysenkoism for the digital age. The wheat didn't grow under Lysenkoism. You can't stop people from copying files on their computers.
That was an editorial by Cory Doctorow, recorded for Search Engine in a hotel room in Yokohama, Japan. Just drink it. In Australia, the Conservative Prime Minister John Howard recently unveiled a piece of government commission software. It was a pornography blocker, which families were invited to download and install onto their home computers. And it cost the Australian taxpayer $84 million to build. But 2 weeks later, a 16-year-old kid named Tom Wood cracked it with a few deft strokes of his keyboard. Search engine reached the young Mr. Wood at his home in Melbourne. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Let me ask you, Tom. The government spends $84 million on this pornography filter, and you cracked it. How did you do it?
I didn't really hack into it in a sense, but I just tried a few different methods of kind of getting around it, and after half an hour I found one that worked pretty well.
You did it in a half an hour?
Yeah, I just, the process involves kind of downloading a tiny utility which provides an interface for some more advanced processes, but it's really quick and easy to do. That could take about 30 seconds if you had instructions. I don't think many kids could have found out how to do it like I did, but if I gave other kids instructions, it's a pretty simple process.
Right. Tom, this may sound like a naive question, but why did you do it?
Oh, I just tried it just to see how strong it would be for a kid who had it on a computer. I was pretty amazed that a project of that size that could just be infiltrated like that.
So it seems like you were kind of motivated just by the challenge of it. It wasn't that you wanted to be able to get through to the content that they were trying to keep you from. And there's no judgment there.
Yeah, it's not. I didn't want to get to porn. That's why I didn't do it. I've kind of been involved in computer safety for kids and stuff and any developments the government makes.
You'd think that the government would be pretty upset with you for pointing out the holes in their filter, but instead I understand that they have shown some interest in your ideas. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, they've shown a little bit of interest in working with the companies on how I actually beat the filters. And I've been kind of discussing with a senior government officer about all this, but from my view, it really could be made a lot more relevant how the government's spending their money in this issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of funny that you got a strong point of view on this, and it seems like you have a desire to help, but only by pointing out the flaws in their system or actually exposing them are you able to kind of get an audience and have a chance to actually execute some of these ideas.
Oh, exactly, because if I went straight to the government if there was a problem, I don't think I would have been able to kind of get in any other help into the whole issue, but through what's happened, it's provided a bit of a platform that I can try and get these issues looked at more by the public. That makes sense.
Yeah, sure. It does. Tom, let me ask you finally this. I mean, what you've done, it could be described as a triumph for 16-year-old boys everywhere. And I know you've been back the new school year for back to school for a couple days now, and I'm wondering, has your social standing improved with your friends since the story broke? Have people been hailing what you accomplished?
Yeah, but every class I go in, everyone yells my name and calls me the porn cracker. People have hailed me as a kind of Aussie hero for doing it.
Well, enjoy it. You've earned it.
Yeah. All right, then. Thanks a lot.
Tom Wood is a 16-year-old high school student living in Melbourne, Australia. We reached him at his home. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a collaborative public radio show. Now, what that means is, whenever we start chasing a story, we post it to our blog at cbc.ca/search engine. Anyone who wants to can come discuss and debate the story online, suggest angles and guests, and correct us when we get our facts wrong. It's like getting the angry letters before we go to broadcast, and it helps us bring you better radio. But in planning this show, we started wondering, if there wasn't some other way to collaborate with our listeners. Somehow to involve the public in the actual production of their public radio. And with that in mind, we're excited to announce Mob Docs. So what's a Mob Doc? Well, a Mob Doc is a radio documentary where anyone in our audience, anywhere in the world, is a potential freelance reporter. From time to time, we'll issue Mob Doc assignments, inviting anyone who's interested to collect audio recordings for us on a specific topic. We'll then weave together the submissions into a finished documentary, which we'll broadcast on the radio. And if we use your recording, we'll pay you, the same as we would any freelancer. So, here's our first Mob Doc assignment. The question is, what does the internet sound like? To give you an idea of what we got in mind, here's something I recorded last year in Israel.
Sounds from the old quarter. I think Arab kids playing Counter-Strike and Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, a little internet cafe in the Arab quarter of the old city.
So what we're looking for here are sounds of what the internet sounds like where you are, whether in the Wi-Fi public parks of Saskatchewan or a UN post in Darfur or a retirement home in Montreal. We're curious about the public sounds of people's private web surfing. Now, if this grabs you, check out our website for all the details. You can also hear other people's submissions as they come in. Once again, we're at cbc.ca/search engine. Just look for Mob Docs. Marshall McLuhan once theorized that new technologies have as much effect on the past as they do on the present and future. Any medium, he wrote, flips back and pulls something out of obsolescence. Take, for example, the effect that email has had on the dying art of letter writing. Now, nothing has proven McLuhan's point more than the internet, where all kinds of forgotten treasures are being dusted off, digitized, tagged, and placed a few clicks away. From time to time, Search Engine will take a parting look at what's new and old. For our first installment of Flipback, we take you to the year 1969. A relatively unknown children's performer named Fred Rogers, who had already had his first kid show canceled by the CBC, is now back on the air in the States and facing a new challenge. The Nixon administration is threatening to drastically chop funding to public broadcasting from $20 to $10 million. So, Mr. Rogers goes to Washington to defend his work before a U.S. Senate committee chaired by Senator John Pastore, which is where we now find him.
All right, Rogers, you got the floor.
Senator Pastore, this is a philosophical statement and would take about 10 minutes to read, so I'll not do that. My first children...
Will it make you happy if you read it?
I'd just like to talk about it, if it's all right. Sir. I'm very much concerned, as I know you are, about what's being delivered to our children in this country. And I've worked in the field of child development for 6 years now, trying to understand the inner needs of children. We deal with such things as the inner drama of childhood. We deal with such things as getting a haircut, or the feelings about brothers and sisters, and the kind of anger that arises in simple family situations. And we speak to it constructively.
How long a program is it?
It's a half hour every day.
Could we get a copy of this so that we can see it? Maybe not today, but I'd like to see the program.
I'd like very much for you
to see it. I'd like to see the program itself, or any one of them, you see.
I end the program by saying, you've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. And I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health.
Do you narrate it?
I'm the host, yes. And I do all the puppets, and I write all the music, and I write all the scripts.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
Well, I'm grateful, not only for your goosebumps, but for your interest in our kind of communication. Could I tell you the words of one of the songs, which I feel is very important?
Yes.
Starts out, what do you do with the mad that you feel? When you feel so mad you could bite. When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong, and nothing you do seems very right. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
Search Engine is produced by myself, Jeff Siskind, Andrew Parker, and the Search Engine online community. We make this show through online collaboration. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/search engine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about today and our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group Search Engine CBC, by email at searchengine@cbc.ca, or by phone at 1-866-399-0927. Special thanks go out today to Rich Platel and Catherine Sampson. I'm Jesse Brown. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.